Oh, I didn't want to do that now. Okay. I'm going to resume.
Awesome. All right. Well, good to see some familiar faces and some of our REV members. I've thrown up a few slides. I think most of you are familiar with our mission for Wealth Wednesdays. This is our fourth Wealth Wednesday. I'm not going to read everything here, but you know, today we have an exciting guest with us to talk about business structures and a whole bunch of other unique opportunities from wealth preservation and maximizing our wealth potential. But I'm going to hand it over to Tom Sullivan, who's going to take us into the meat of today. We'll get into today's Wealth Wednesday.
All right, Lynn, thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. My name is Tom Sullivan, and I'm an MBA 28. I will be graduating at the end of April. We're all very super excited about that. I'll be moderating our discussion with Don, and we're going to move forward. I ask for your patience because we have to do a few disclosures. You'll see a disclosure in the chat covering past performance does not guarantee future results, and everything we say, can, or do in this meeting, we are not accountants or attorneys or your personal financial advisor. I myself am a FINRA and NASA licensed and registered general securities representative, broker-dealer, registered representative and agent, and an investment advisor representative in the states of Virginia, Michigan, as well as many other states. I'm also licensed in Virginia for health, life, and annuities and variable contracts insurance. Now that that's done, let's get back to the exciting part of this Wealth Wednesday, and we're going to talk to Don Thornton. Raph, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, Don, I got to try to get you up here in my little video viewer, but want to introduce Don. I met Don after doing some research for Wealth Wednesday, after stumbling across some content. And I want to say it was Reddit. I believe that's where I kind of tripped up. Yeah, it was Reddit. And, watched a lot of videos, and then I was like, all right, I need to reach out to this guy because I think there's definitely some overlap. So Don Thornton, he is an entrepreneur known as a short sale guy in the real estate industry, has a company, HB Funding. Crazy to think Don speaks five languages, even if they're not that great, just kind of half speak those languages. That's pretty impressive. I would also say that, Don's an MBA, has probably all the same understanding that we have in terms of finance and how we look at, things from that perspective. And more than anything, Don is an infinite wealth strategist, Dave, who's been our guest on a few Wealth Wednesdays and before Wealth Wednesday even existed, Dave Greenlee down here at the bottom. Well, my bottom left anyways. And so today, I'm really excited to get into trusts, entities, and understanding the flow of funds. So Don, thank you. I also want to introduce Renee. I did not know you were going to be here. So Renee, if you could give yourself a quick intro, we'd love that. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. I've been lucky enough to work with Don for a number of years, also negotiating short sales, and pivoting to marketing in this trust has been very successful. We're helping a lot of people manage their finances. So we're glad to be here.
Awesome. Very cool. So Tom, Don, welcome. Tom, going to turn, the stage over to you. And really looking forward to the conversation. Welcome, everyone. Let's get going.
All right. Thank you, Raph, for that great introduction. Don, we are all excited to have this conversation with you now that our intros and disclosures are over. I'll start off by asking the very most basic of questions, which is tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, we only have an hour, right?
That's why I said a little bit.
Keep it to the top three best things.
All right. Well, you guys said in the introduction, I'm known as Don the Short Sale Guy in real estate. 21 years I've been doing short sales. I am one of the leading investors in short sales in the country. And I, at the risk of being arrogant, I am probably know more about short sales than most realtors or people who are licensed to do them, because We have flipped well over 3,000 short sales in that period of time. And that led me indirectly to what we're talking about today, is that the more successful you get, the more money you pay in taxes. And I always had that issue. For some, I don't know what it was, after about a year and a half of starving, learning how to do short sales, it blew up. You know, I went from literally supplementing my diet with gas card hot dogs and Slurpees at 7-Eleven to making close to $1 million. The first year I broke through was like, you know, and I had no idea how to handle money, not that kind of money. And so it's been a slow and arduous process during that time, but I never could figure out the tax part of it. And so it wasn't until last year or so where I was able to really find the solution that I've been looking for. And, you know, I'll just be honest with you, short sales are slow right now. It's been a very appreciating market. Our niche is bad markets, people who are upside down their mortgages. Not many people are upside down their mortgages. So, you know, the idea of maximize your assets. I said, well, you know what? I know about this amazing trust and I have it. And why not, you know, use this time to educate as many people as I can about it? That's kind of my background.
Don, thanks for that. As you already mentioned, we're going to be talking about trust today and the relationship with us, our family, and our businesses. Very few people understand the terminology and technicalities of trust until they discover that they need one. And by then, it's usually too late when they figure out that they absolutely needed one. And man, they wish they could have had one 10 or 20 years before that. So we're going to talk about some trust structures a little bit later in our conversation, but we're going to start with some basics. So what is a trust? On your blog, you talk about contract law versus legislative for all, IRS code 643. What can you tell us a little bit about trust and how that's involved?
Well, at its very core, a trust is just a contract. Right? I mean, it is a contract between two entities, it could be a person, two people. The whole idea is that it is designed to do a specific thing, and that's the trust governing instrument. And so, you know, the Constitution, the right to contract, Article 1, Section 10, I'm sure most people know about that. The government cannot get in the way of a contract between two people. Although, you know, obviously, if you have a contract, you know, between a drug dealer and a supplier, you know, even though it's a contract and the government's not supposed to be getting in the middle of that, they're going to get in the middle of that. So, you know, this whole life, there are people out there that wave a broad brush about contract law, and no, you can't be doing illegal or fraudulent stuff with it. But the idea of the contract is true. If I have a bicycle and I bought it for $100 and I decide that I want to sell it to my neighbor, you know, I can sell it whatever price I want. We will have a contract together, and nobody gets involved in that. That is a contract between two parties. And so I'm not an attorney. I don't claim to be. I only play one on TV. But, you know, it's one of those deals where, you know, when you understand that, okay, so we have a contract that is allowed to do certain things, and you're allowed to do certain things as a trustee, you're allowed to do certain things as a beneficiary. And as long as you are compliant with applicable local law, which is in the tax code and in our trust document, that you're free to do it and nobody can get in the way of it.
Speaking on laws, how are trusts regulated? Is it at the state level or is it at the federal level?
Well, there's a federal level, and I don't, you know, I forgive me for not knowing remembering the exact name, but there is statutory law trusts. These are trusts that basically were created by some act of a legislature. Okay. So if a legislature in some way, shape, or form created a trust, it's going to be regulated by the government. And they'll act a little. I think it's like the Uniform Code of Trust something. I forget the actual name, but it's there. But most, and then of course, states can also regulate their, you know, trust in their jurisdiction.
Fantastic. Thanks for answering that question. Now we got trustors, grantors, trustees, executors, beneficiaries. What's the difference?
Well, again, it's a little bit different with our trust as it is with regular statutory trust. In general, the trust that most people are familiar with, you know, family trust, living trust, things like that. You know, the whole idea is you have a third party trustee, usually, usually it's an attorney or somebody like that. And then the trust is almost designed as a pass-through in a sense that any money or any, you know, benefits would be flowing down to the beneficiaries. And in those types of trusts, the beneficiaries are the ones that have the tax burden. Okay. So and our trust is a little different, and we can get into that a little bit later. But you know, it's a lot of them are used, you know, they are designed to stop probate, right? If something happens to us, we don't want our property to go into probate. You know, it's stronger than a will, and that's what a lot of it is. Or, you know, people want to set up some parameters, some control, so that way they can determine how they want their wealth to be spent or invested when they're gone. That's, I would say, probably 90% of the people, you know, who think about a trust think about that. Another 10% think about Rockefeller and trust fund babies and things like that. But,
well, talking about Rockefeller and trust fund babies, our next question just rolls into that. Who needs a trust? Why do I need it? And how do I know if it's right for me?
You know, I think that, I mean, I talk to a lot of people, and every day I have 10, 20, 30 people sometimes reach out to me and they ask me about what they're doing. I do free strategy sessions with them. And I oftentimes tell them they don't need a trust, you know. And I would say that, you know, if you don't have any assets, there's nothing to protect. And that's one of the biggest core reasons why people want to get a trust, is they want to protect their assets. And in our particular trust, you know, we also have some amazing tax reduction strategies through the trust that for tax reduction reasons, it makes sense to get that. But, you know, most trusts don't really have a lot of tax reduction, and they're mostly geared towards the asset protection side of it.
Thank you. I've learned a little bit about trusts acting as an individual from a legal perspective, but it's very insulated and protected. And it's really interesting, the trust interplay from a legal perspective as far as how the tax code works and how, you know, you can even open up a life insurance policy on a trust technically, and the rates are really low because technically trust, it can't get old and get sick. So it's really interesting how that works. With why are trusts like tax deferred? Like, why would we use one versus an LLC, or can we use them in conjunction with the LLC? And also, we can write off expenses with trusts.
Well, we're talking about the trust that I have. Yes,
sure.
So if you want me to talk about, you know, what the trust that I have, absolutely, you can. We don't defer taxes. There's with this trust, any kind of passive income that comes into it is not a taxable event. And according to the code that this trust is governed by, you know, the trustee has the power to determine whether any passive income that comes in the trust is considered income or not. And there's a mechanism in place that allows the trustee to declare that all this passive income that's come in during a tax year is not income. And if it's not income, it's not taxable. So this trust is unique in that point of view, where the tax code actually allows the trustee to determine what is income and what is not income. And that's a unique feature of this trust that most trusts have.
I think you're touching on some of the next questions I have in line, which is, you know, can a trustor serve as a trustee for their own trust?
Well, it depends on what kind of trust you have. If it's a non-grantor trust, then no. If it's a grantor trust, then that the person who, you know, sets the trust up and then, you know, is but the problem with that is that the IRS looks at a grantor trust as an alter ego of the person who set it up. So they're not, there's no tax benefits there. You're just going to get taxed at whatever your bracket is as an individual, that, you know, it's all going to flow down to you. And if it doesn't flow down to you, the tax rates for statutory trust are very high. So there's no incentive for anyone to keep the money in the trust. So it's designed to pass through down to the individuals.
The beneficiaries, you mentioned.
Beneficiaries, yes.
Excuse yeah. me, yes. Okay. Yeah. And so I had one question for clarity. I don't want to hold us up or whatever. But so when you said for the income that comes into the trust, even though it's passive, the trustee is the one that actually can make that claim on whether that was actual income or not.
Yes.
And it's in the IRS has nothing.
It's in a tax code. It's yeah. in a tax code.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it basically says that it, for this type of trust, and listen, you have, it's not like every single trust can do this. This is very strict requirements on whether a trust is in compliance with this code. It's IRS code 643B. But basically, there's two, it has to be non-grantor, it has to be irrevocable, it has to be a complex trust, and it has to be discretionary. Those four things have to be there to even come close to qualifying for 643B. But it also, the trust language, the governing instrument, cannot be required to distribute to beneficiaries. And second of all income has to be allocated to the corpus of the trust. So if it's in compliance, and our trust is, then the tax code will allow the trustee to determine if that passive income is an extraordinary dividend or not. And by declaring that to be an extraordinary dividend, then that is not considered income in the tax code. And if it's not income, it ain't taxable.
Right. Yeah, I think that's so unique in the sense you can be like, hey, this is not income, you know? So then I'm just going to, that's the way I'm going to leave it. And, you know, I'm the trustee. So, okay, cool. Sorry, Tom, feel free.
No. Raph, you're more welcome. So from what I'm seeing, Don, it's you get to declare when something is income and when it isn't, which can allow you to have compounded returns and without having a tax implication, right? And this is where you're talking about like deferring taxes indefinitely.
Well, we don't defer them, and they're just not, it's not taxable.
You it's just not taxable.
It's okay. Just not income. If it's not income, it's not taxable. But I would like to understand, so you understand, this only has to do with passive income. We're talking about investment income, lease income, rental income, limited partnership, profit sharing. That those are all, you know, royalties, okay? That is passive income. Now, if you try to use this trust and run a business with it and generate active business income, you're going to pay every single dime in taxes that's out there. So, you know, you can only run this with passive income coming into it. Now, you can use the trust with another entity, an LLC or an S-corp, for example, to be able to drastically reduce the entity's taxable income by working in concert with the trust. But it still has to be converted from active to passive income before it comes into trust.
From an estate perspective, trusts also are very protected against the estate tax limits. You know, usually once you're over a certain limit, you start paying out the nose and taxes on estate taxes. But this is part of the reason trusts exist. It's to help isolate from that, right?
Yes. And this trust is the same way. I mean, you know, it's an irrevocable trust. So when you want to get an asset inside the trust, you have to sell it into the trust. There has to be a bill of sale. And, you know, it depends if it's real property, it has to be a deed as well. And so that means it's once that property goes into, or that asset goes into the trust, it is a trust asset. You just can't pull it back and let the trust have to sell it back. Now, the way we do this in this trust is that we sell it at a cost basis. So therefore, it's not going to be a taxable event when you get in there. So, but once it's in there as long as a trustee who has 100% discretion that has all the power, makes all the decisions about what to do with it. So, you know, you can sell it out, of course. And we have a lot of people in real estate, including myself, that the trust purchases these assets, and then you do your rehabs, whatever you want to do with it. You know, trust sells it. And the nice thing about this trust is that because it's 100% compliant with IRS code 643B, any capital gains taxes are not a taxable event for this trust. So if I have any kind of, if I sell a property, if I sell crypto, if I sell any asset that was going to have a capital gains tax issue, as long as it is a trust asset when it's sold, and it comes into the trust and it stays inside the corpus, it's not a taxable event. It's not deferred. Understand that it's not deferring. We're not deferring anything, like you can with 1031 exchanges or anything else. It's not a taxable event. Period.
Right, because it's not considered income. Right. So the other question I would have is that, I'm not even going to go down that rabbit hole. I'm going to keep it high level. So keep going.
Raph, let's save that for the Q&A section at the end of this. rabbit holes are fun. You can find some really interesting things at the bottom of those if you get there. Don, thanks so much for talking about all this so far. What happens with these trusts if you die? Or, you know, like, is there ways to set up a trust in order to pass it on to your inheritors? What's that look like?
Yes. And for legacy planning purposes? My trust right now, I'm the trustee. I'm also the compliance overseer. So I have 100% power in the trust. I have my wife, my two adult children, and my grandson are my beneficiaries. So I have named my wife my successor trustee. So if I get incapacitated or something happens, then she takes over. My oldest daughter, my daughter is successor trustee if something happens to my wife and I together. So it is designed to go generation after generation. All you have to do is every 21 years is just renew it inside your trust book, and you're golden. Just keep going as long as you want. And the whole idea is that the wealth that my wife and I have been able to generate in our lifetime, we want our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren to be able to take advantage of that and have access to it. So to answer your question, this goes on as long as you want to. I mean, some of the Rockefeller Trust, I think, was formed in the early 1900s. It's still going strong. They have like almost 400 members in the trust. It's still going. And hopefully mine will last that long as well.
Multi-generational wealth at its finest. Mm-hmm. And making sure we talk about that a little bit. Actually, Raph, at a previous meeting, talked about this book called Entrusted, mm-hmm. which is really interesting. It talks about the responsibilities of families to really effectively create a mission statement around a trust and to make that a strong familial bond as the trust is established, so that people understand what is the purpose of it, how is it going to be utilized, and to really, you know, work as a team behind it rather than fighting against it. So a really great book for anybody who doesn't know about it. You'll find a link to it in our Slack channel, I believe, if you scroll back in the history a little bit. Really good book. So let's talk about the non-grantor, irrevocable, complex, discretionary, spendthrift trust, mm-hmm. which you label as the five pillars of, yes. you know, financial success within trust. So can you talk a little bit about each of those pillars? Like, what are they? Why is your trust, why is it such a mouthful? I'm guessing there's a legal purpose behind that. Love for you to talk a little bit about that, Don.
All right. Well, non-grantor basically means that, you know, if you're going to be a I'm the trustee. I did not form my own trust. Okay. If I form my own trust, it's a grantor trust. And the reason why this is so important, because in our particular trust, the tax reduction strategies are so amazing that, you know, you can't do it if it's a grantor trust. So it has to be non-grantor. So, you know, so the way that works is that a settlor. Settlor is the one that actually creates the trust. That's the, that person's social is on the EIN. And then that person names me as the trustee, whoever is going to be the trustee in someone else's trust. And then that person resigns, is gone. So now the trust existed before I was named as trustee. Now I'm trustee. I have 100% discretion, but I did not form the trust. Therefore, it is a non-grantor trust. It is also an irrevocable trust, which means that assets are not transferred into the trust. They are sold into the trust. So they become a trust asset. And so the way we sell our assets in the trust in a way that would not trigger a capital gains tax event is that we sell them at a cost basis, you know, plus any improvements that have been made, subtract whatever depreciation have been taken in previous tax years, subtract any financing on the property, and then what are the asset, whatever is left over, that is the sale amount that's being sold to the trust. And the trust does not give money in exchange for that, because it has to be it's a transaction, so there has to be consideration. In this case, the trust gives a demand note, IOU, return of capital. So basically the trust is going to say, look, this is the value that's being given. We owe you this money, and it's called demand note because if I sold my assets into the trust, I can demand compensation whenever I want, and that will not be a taxable event for me, because it's just basically return of capital. So that's why it's an irrevocable trust. Sometimes people say, well, I'm unsure about doing an irrevocable trust because that means I'm stuck. And I, you know, it's like, no, it only means irrevocable in the point of view that the sale of the asset to the trust is irrevocable. It is a complex trust and not a simple trust. Most simple trusts are designed to have everything passed through down to the beneficiaries. This is a complex trust. So therefore, and this is really important to be in compliance with the tax code, is that the governing instrument of the trust, the language itself, cannot require distributions to be made to beneficiaries. Okay. So if it's a complex trust, then that is one of the things that allows us to be in compliance with the tax code, IRS code 643B. So if it's a simple trust, it wouldn't work. And oh, by the way, one of the reasons why Wesley Snipes went to jail, because he was involved in trust fraud, was because he was trying to use a simple trust and in a way that it was not allowed, which was to get tax benefits from it. And that doesn't work in a simple trust. So and the fourth pillar is the discretionary trust. It's a discretionary pillar, which basically means that the trustee has to have 100% discretion power, if you want to call it that, to be able to run the trust. And the reason why that's important is because as I mentioned before earlier about declaring all the passive income that comes in the trust as an extraordinary dividend, well, that trustee has to have 100% discretion to do that. And that's why the discretionary part of it's so important to be able to declare any passive income to be the extraordinary dividend, which means it's not income and means it's not taxable. And the spendthrift pillar, that has nothing to do with the tax part of it. It has everything to do with the asset protection. So the spendthrift provision basically means that unless you committed fraudulent conveyance when you sold your assets in the trust, or you were doing fraudulent or criminal activity in the trust, then it cannot be penetrated. Those are the only two reasons why it can be penetrated. Otherwise, it's locked down. It has the best asset protection that's out there. I mean, case in point, O.J. Simpson does not have our trust, but his trust does have a spendthrift provision. And for those of you who know, the Goldmans have been trying to crack that trust for 20 plus years, and they haven't got close to getting his assets because of the spendthrift provision. It's so powerful, it can stop eminent domain lawsuits in their tracks. So, you know, it's a very powerful thing. So the first four have to do mostly with the tax and being in compliance with 643B. Spendthrift part of it has to do with asset protection.
The spendthrift part of it is, there is some state limitations, right? Because spendthrift trusts are not available in all states, but there is a good like 10 or so states that do offer it.
There's a lot of different trusts out there, and they all have a certain, they can choose, they want to have a spendthrift provision in their trust. Our trust, the spendthrift provision works in all 50 states. So there's no restriction on our trust as far as the spendthrift provision goes.
Okay. And going back to basics real quick, you mentioned something, and I want to remind everyone, you do have to fund your trust with cash in order to kind of start this or fund it with assets that can start being utilized as, yes, as a cash flow instrument. In order to sell something, your trust needs to be able to buy it, which is important.
Yeah, no. The trust gives a note.
IOUs.
Yeah, in exchange for assets being sold.
Yeah.
So right. The trust needs, you know, the trust, I mean, I have clients that don't have an income source for their trust. They're just using it to park their assets and to make sure that they're protected from any lawsuits. But most people get this trust for both the asset protection and the tax reduction strategies. So in my particular case, I put $25 in my trust account, sold my assets in the trust. But then because I'm working my real estate investing business in conjunction with my trust, I was moving, and I still do, as much as 90%+ of my income of my S-Corp over to the trust. And so that's where the money goes, flows into the trust, where it's being converted from active business income into passive income for the trust, where it's not taxable. But as trustee, I control it. So I can use that to invest in other properties and pay for trust expenses if I want to. It's all in my purview. I have the power to do that as trustee.
And that's something that you can talk about as a strategist. Anybody here in this room could set up an appointment with you to kind of talk over, like, how does that work for my business? How can I, what are some of the intricacies of that? And how can I make that work for me? Actually, in the chat, Lynn has asked a really good question. Why don't they teach this in business school?
Well, I think a lot of it is because there's a general ignorance about trusts, especially this trust. And it's partly the attorneys who started the trust, you know, 70 years ago, they never really promoted it. And that's the thing about it. If you, most attorneys, most CPAs, they don't really get into trusts unless you really want to specialize in trusts. There's an elective that you can get in law school for one semester of trust. Most of them don't take it, right? They don't. So they're familiar with what they know. They know statutory law trust. They know living trust. They know maybe an irrevocable trust or a non-grantor trust or a grantor trust. They have certain trusts they know about. That's what they do. And they don't know about a trust that has been around for 70 years, but until recently was never really in the public eye. So just a real quick history on this. Robert Benson was one of the authors and original partners who was doing spendthrift trust, you know, for the very beginning. Basically, he was a student at Harvard, taught at Harvard, and then, you know, he was lured to Wall Street, and he basically spent his first 20 years of his career doing spendthrift trusts for Wall Street fat cats. And then he decided to go off on his own. He got another partner whose name escapes me. I apologize. But until he passed, you know, after 2000, I think it's like 2010 or something like that. You know, he was the managing partner, and he actually copyrighted the trust. But it was mostly used, the first 40, 50 years was mostly in a very niche market for people in Texas, Louisiana, oil producing areas who had more mineral, oil, and gas rights. Mm-hmm. It was designed to protect their interests, protect their assets, and also to legally reduce their taxes to almost laughable level. And they were the main contingent, the main clients of this trust. So when they copyrighted it in 2001, I believe, that's when they started to come out of the, you know, come out of the wilderness, as you want to put it that way. And they started getting more and more awareness of the trust. The law firm made it, made a decision that they were going to allow it to be sold. And, you know, they still control it. It's their trust. Every single trust that is created, they create themselves, you know, and so, but they are, allow a couple of companies, one of which I'm a part of, to promote the trust, sell it, and then do all the post-sale customer service, getting everything set up, and then being available for questions and so on and so forth. So I would say that just for me alone, in a year of promoting this trust, when I first started, I'd say the first 4 or 5 months, I didn't, nobody had even heard about it. But what's been happening on the internet the last 6 months, I have people coming to me all the time saying, I've been hearing about this trust. I'm really interested. You know, whereas before I would bring it up and I never heard of that, you know. So there's been a definite shift. And I believe in the next 2 or 3 years, you know, you're going to see it's going to really be on everybody's radar. And from a real estate investing point of view, you know, there's no reason to ever do a 1031 exchange. Or if you're a business owner, there's no reason for you ever to pay capital gains tax if you use this trust, because it is simply excluded as a taxable event for any trust assets. So it's really gaining momentum in the real estate investing community and even in the business community, especially for those businesses that are getting ready to sell. In fact, we just signed an agreement with a business brokerage. It's, I think they're like in 13, 14 states, called Hedgestone, where we are actively consulting with their business owner clients to sell their assets into a trust before they sell it, their business, and they do an asset sale. So therefore, none of the proceeds from the sell their business are a tax or a capital gains taxable event.
So I have one question, because I think some people are going to talk about, okay, if I move all my assets and all the income and everything is going in there, how do I survive? Right? We had this conversation where we talked, which is the trust expenses and, or what is a qualified trust expense? So maybe we want to talk about that for a second before we move into the, to this next kind of topic, I guess.
Well, I like to illustrate how I work it, because I think it does a good job of painting a picture of how this really works in real life. So my income is real estate investing. I do some consulting. I do have some courses for short sales. And so I do have active business income that comes into my S-corp. So I also have my trust where I'm a trustee of. So what happened is that when I set my trust up, I sold all my business assets into the trust. So now the trust owns them. My trust is a shell. My S-corp is a shell. I did the same thing with my business assets, my personal assets. So now the trust leases those back to the S Corp for it to be able to generate revenue. And the IRS will allow up to 70% of the previous year's net income to be used as a lease agreement. So if I have $1 million of net income for my S Corp, I can move $700,000 of that over to the trust as part of a lease agreement, which is passive income for the trust. And so I'm lowering my taxable income down to from $1 million down to $300,000, which of course is going to significantly lower the tax I'm going to pay for my S Corp. So that money that is now, that $700,000 is now inside my trust. I can invest in more things if I want to, but I also can use that money that's not taxable to pay for trust expenses. So there's two categories. You have the trust, you have expenses for any assets. So any asset whatsoever that's inside your trust, the trust is obligated to pay for that. So if you sell your primary residence into the trust, then it's going to pay for your mortgage, your insurance, you know, property taxes, anything having to do with it. The kid that comes by and mows your lawn, trust pays for that. You know, you want to put a new roof on, trust pays for that. If you have some kind of an insurance issue and you got to pay deductible, the trust pays for that. Anything at all of any sort of expense whatsoever having to do with any asset of the trust pays for. Now, it can also pay for a very high percentage of the expenses for beneficiaries. I'll give you an example. My grandson is 4 years old. We've already got him in, you know, preschool, and he's got some tutoring and so forth. He's as a minor beneficiary, the trust pays for everything for him, everything, food, clothes, fun, whatever you want to have, it pays for. My son is 21. He's in his sophomore year of college. So the trust pays for pretty much everything for him as well, including his university, his tuition, his meal plan, all that. It's all paid for, okay, because he's being educated. Now, my daughter, she's married, has a kid, obviously my grandson, and my wife, they are beneficiaries. So the trust can pay for a lot of their expenses, but it's easier to illustrate this by saying what the trust can't pay for than what it can. So we call it the four F's: food, fashion, fun, and faceless. Okay. So, and it just what it means, what it says, but obviously like anything else, there's lots of gray areas. So for example, Renee is in Pensacola seeing her daughter. I'm going to fly out there in a couple of days, and we're going to do some stuff, but I'm also going to meet a client. And we're also going to an event that we've been asked to talk about the trust with. So trust is paying for that, right? It's a trust expense. But if we want to go to an amusement park or something, then it's not a trust expense. You know? So the biggest shock, well, the second biggest shock was the fact that it was so, I didn't realize how easy it was to run a trust, this trust. I thought it'd be more complicated. But the other one was just how much you can pay for. But to answer your question, there are certain things it won't pay for. It cannot pay for as a legitimate trust expense. So getting back to the asset sale, when I sold all of our assets into the trust, all of our rental properties, all of our apartments, everything, plus my, you know, all the business assets, all my intellectual property, you know, my courses, everything that I've done in my entire life that has to do with my professional, in my career, then that was sold to the trust. Now, the trust gave me a demand note, an IOU, like we talked about. So here's how I do it. I have a trust debit card. Every single dime I spend in my life is with my trust debit card. Okay. So if for some reason, let's say $40,000 throughout the year was on food, fashion, and fun, that wasn't a trust expense, then all I have to do in my QuickBooks is move that from a trust expense over to the demand note, and just reduces my demand note by whatever amount that was. Either way, neither of that is a taxable event. So that's how I mean, I live in and through my trust, and it's a brilliant strategy.
So question on that demand note, are you actually earning interest too? Because it'd probably take you forever to exhaust that. Is there?
Yeah, I mean, we have like 0.05 interest that it makes. And frankly, you know, it's taxable, right? Yeah. So I do pay, you know, as a, you know, the trust does a little bit on that, but it's very minimal, of course, and that's not even at all.
One other question for that is, you sold all your assets. Can your other family members sell their assets under the trust as a beneficiary?
Well, my wife and I, you know, we were all assets in common, so we both sold them, you know, mm-hmm. So. The kids don't have any assets, and you know, my grandson certainly doesn't. So it's just our joint assets we were sold in the trust.
Yeah. So I guess what I was saying is that as your children get older and they become, you know, they acquire assets, would they sell them into the trust essentially and have it be like an interbank or interbank type trust?
It's up to them. But remember that in this trust, there's only one trustee. Or excuse me, you can have joint trustees, but one person has to have total control to be in compliance with 643. And so that's a compliance overseer. So absolutely, family members can sell their assets in the trust and they get a part of the demand note as well, but one person controls it. So, you know, right now, my daughter, my son, they are living in apartments that now the trust owns, but they're beneficiaries, so they live there for free, and so it's protected. you know, from, you know, and anything having to do with that, anything having to do with those apartments are trust expenses. So right. The trust pays for everything.
Got it. So cool. Yeah. I mean, I think we could probably talk on day, you know, for days in terms of strategy and how to, you know, everybody's situation is different, situational. And I know we're running out of time. I wanted to get some Q&As from people if they had questions, but everybody's situation is different. You know, some of us are just W-2 people, right? W-2 employees, high earners. What is the strategy for that? I'm a business owner. I get, you know, I have a W-2. I also have distributions. I have, you know, real estate. I have, you know, other assets, IP. You know, everybody's situation is going to be a little different. And so that's why I was so excited to bring us all together so that we could just get high enough level to start speaking kind of intelligently about the things that, you know, that we kind of know and heard of, but we can't really.
Well, the thing about this, but you can also, like I said, for high earning W-2, if you're making $400,000-$600,000 or more in W-2, you can use this trust along with a charitable trust to be able to move a substantial amount of that money out of the claws of the IRS and move it over to there. And then you can use it instead of like, I'll be real quick because we're out of time. If as a W-2 employee, I can donate anything I want to a charitable institution, I will get a deduction from that. Okay. Problem is that if you do that, that money's gone, right? I mean, the American Cancer Society, great, you got it, go cure cancer. But it doesn't do me any good other than the deduction. However, if you set up a charitable trust, and let's say I make $600,000 a year and I want to reduce that by a lot, I can move as much as 60% of my adjusted gross income. Let's just say $300,000. I can move that over to the, I can donate that to the charitable trust, which is also a 501c3. And 95% of that charitable donation, well, I get that donate that credit immediately, deduction immediately. So from my W-2, $300,000 is gone. I get a deduction from my taxes on that. But on the trust side, 5% stays inside the charitable trust and used for whatever purposes the charitable trust is set up for. But 95% of that can be invested. And every time I take profit from that, it goes down to my spendthrift, my personal trust. And that's also a non-taxable event. So there's also ways to be able to reduce, you know, your W-2 income.
W-2s.
Yes.
Is that different than a remaining charitable trust, or is it the same?
It's a little different. It's a little different. I think our trust is unique in the sense that you can invest so much of a donation, quote unquote, and you're the trustee of the charitable trust as well, yeah. And then the money will flow down to your personal trust. Yeah. As a non-taxable event. You never recapture the original donation. That's always going to stay in a trust.
Right.
But you can keep plucking the interest into your
business. Yep. Got it. Sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
Don, this is very confusing. There's a lot going on here.
Yes.
Do you recommend that someone who's going to start pursuing this type of trust has a specialist CPA? Or attorney to turn to, or how do you recommend to set this up? Also, adding in Lynn's question in the chat, what are the fixed costs as well?
I would say that as a general rule, a lot of it depends on how sophisticated the strategy someone wants to work. I would say that, you know, $25,000 is our basic trust. Okay, it can go up to as much as $70,000, $80,000 depending on what you want to do and how sophisticated, how many partners you have, how complicated the strategies are. So, but I would say $25,000 is you know, the personal trust.
And is there a way to offset that expense against our actual, like our W-2 income or our end of year income, taxable income?
Yeah, you can, first of all, you can write it off, but I can tell you from my experience, yeah, I made a profit on my first tax year after I implemented the strategy with my trust.
Yeah.
So my investment was more than recouped on my first year by what I saved on taxes.
Yeah, totally get it. Yeah, does anybody have any questions out there? Everyone's really quiet. Like,
yeah, let's do our coffees. Q&A.
Yeah. Crickets.
Wow.
Yeah. Covered some good ground today. If we have a few minutes, I think, like, you know, going back to what, you know, Tom was saying, one, you know, the cost and everything else to set it up, but I didn't know how much time we would have, but the interplay between the trust and business structures, LLCs, corps, C corps, all that other stuff goes back to the conversation, or at least the point that I was trying to make, is that we all have situational experiences. So as we try to plan, you know, because you always want to know what you're going to buy and how you're going to, you know, you're going to lay it all out. It's like you're building your house, right? Picking out cabinets and, you know, all that other stuff. What is the, you know, what is the process or the experience of actually getting to that, you know, designing the house before you actually pull the trigger and buy it?
Well, I mean, if you have an LLC, it's very simple how you do it. If you have a single member LLC, you got to make it a multi-member, because a trust, you're going to make the trust a 90% member, limited member of your LLC. So you're going to have 10%, but you're going to have all the control, right? And so you're always going to sell your business assets to the trust. And then the trust will lease those back. The lease back strategy is very well known. It's not unique to this trust, but you're going to be able to move as much as 70% of that your company's taxable income over to the trust. So if I start with $1 million, like I had in my example, and I move $700,000 over as part of a lease back strategy, that leaves me with $300,000 that's taxable. Now, since I made my trust a 90% limited member of the LLC, that I can move 90% of that remaining $300,000 over to the trust, you know, as limited partnership or profit sharing, K-1. Right. So now at the end of my tax year, I legally can get that taxable income from my LLC from $1 million down to 30,000.
Got it. Because 90% distributed.
All you're doing, and people don't understand the strategy, will say, well, you can't do that because that's a violation of the assignment of income that the IRS talks about, that he who you know earns the income pays the taxes. It's the corp LLC, they still are responsible for whatever taxes are. All we're doing is the trust is creating two additional expenses for the LLC. Paying for a lease to get assets, that is a legitimate business expense that goes off the books as an expense for the LLC, and, you know, limited partnership profit sharing, again, that goes over as an expense. So all we're doing is just expense, you know, converting this active business income into passive income for the trust. So the lower that goes on your company side, the less you're going to pay in taxes. And then whatever is moved over as an expense to the trust, as trustee, according to the tax code, I can declare that an extraordinary dividend. And every single dime is accounted for in the tax return, but it zeros out because it's declared an extraordinary dividend. And according to the code, that means it is not income.
Income, yeah. One other file. So the IOU from the purchase of the asset, the lease back, is that IOU in the name of the LLC? Then at that point,
the trust owes, you know, to me, or whoever sells the asset gets the demand note.
Right.
So we in my family we have two demand notes. So our demand note is $2.8 million and change, okay? So $500,000 of that was business assets. So that goes to me because I'm the president of the company. And then the $2,300 is split, the $2.3 million is split 50-50 between me and my wife. So if we ever get divorced, she gets her cut and I get my cut. That's it. The assets stay inside the trust. And in this situation, I would be the one that would retain control because I'm that compliance overseer and she's a beneficiary. And as the sole power of the trust, I guess I can remove her whenever I want.
Right.
Now I can't remove her, you know, her right to get the demand note. I mean, the trust would have to pay her, of course, right. Yeah. But I'm just saying that's from a asset protection point of view, that's the world's best prenuptial agreement. You know, it earns in a trust, and you can remove, you know, trustees, or not, sorry, I'm sorry, beneficiaries at your discretion.
Well, Don, we talked about the trust acting as a legal entity, as a person under the eyes of the law, in many respects. And a trust can actually hold a board seat on a company and make votes towards it. It's really interesting that the interplay of how a trust can actually help run companies, depending on, you know, the guidelines that the trust is established behind. So that's really interesting, is how some of these large old companies retain major ownership as a whole family, because the family is entrusted to the trust, and then that trust holds the board seat and also the majority shares. And so that's how they can keep ownership of the company asset in perpetuity, without having to worry about dilution of equity after people pass away. So there's some really interesting interplays there with how trust can help you run a company or own said company for multi-generations.
Yeah, so I have clients that do not have any heirs. And so they have made their alma mater a beneficiary of the trust. So that when they go, they have instructions that the assets are liquidated and the university gets the assets, and the trust will be dissolved. So yeah, I mean, you can have, it's not just people, it can be entities is also can be beneficiaries of the trust.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, we got our final minute here with Wealth Wednesdays with Don. Lynn, do you have any quick questions to wrap this up? Raf, yourself, anybody else within this room? I know we've had a quiet room. We're just trying to process all of this information because it is mind blowing, like Lynn is showing. Who do we, Don, you get to selflessly promote yourself now for like the next minute. How do we contact you? What's the best way to talk about this stuff? Who are the right people and where do we start?
I'm the right person. Just reach out to me. I'm an old school person. I mean, I do have a website, of course. I do have a capture page, all the funnel stuff you want to talk about. But you know what? Just take my phone number down. It's 407-902-7827. Just text me. Give me a call. I'd be glad to talk to you. We can set up a time. You know, it's good for you, good for me. And we can chit chat and go over your situation, see, you know, how the trust would help you, and, you know, give you all the information you need to do your due diligence.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Appreciate that so much.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I'm sure we're going to have a trillion questions. Our next Wealth Wednesday kind of does go into another layer where we look at, you know, different types of, you know, vehicles. And really this whole Wealth Wednesdays concept is to just help people plan and eventually make their way to operating like a family office, right? And being able to, you know, invest, protect their wealth for generations to come. And I just feel like it's a topic that's not discussed, crazy as it sounds, for, you know, executives that, you know, that are very intelligent group of people. So, you know, I just want to thank you for your time and the information. And, you know, if you're okay with it, we'd certainly love to invite you back, to get through some more strategy and kind of, you know, take a little bit of a lower level. And really, ultimately, you know, come December, all of us walk out with a playbook on what our plans are going to be. And then we can start executing from that perspective. But I will agree with you. It's hard to get a tax attorney, you know, a trust attorney. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm an accountant's like, you know, a lawyer's like, I'm not an accountant, and vice versa. And bringing these folks together under the same discipline and understanding has been so challenging. It's probably like the hardest thing I've ever done. I've called 20 trust attorneys and they're like, yeah, no, I'm not interested in getting into a group of people to have a conversation, or a tax planner or a tax attorney or an LLM. It's been across the board. It's just been really fascinating, the oil and water and vinegar thing that's going on with some of these, you know, professionals. Is just, it's my mission to bring everybody together. So,
thank you.
On that note,
yeah, that's a wrap.
Lynn, you got anything? Lynn, real quick, you got anything that you want to outro with?
I think everything that's been said has been amazing. So thank you so much for your time, Don. And shouldn't put your number out. You're going to be getting a lot of calls and text messages.
I'm fine. I'm a frustrated professor. My career path was to be a professor of Russian language, and I got sidetracked when the wall fell and I was over in Russia. But I still love to teach. And so I don't teach Russian anymore, but I do teach this. And I love to teach this because it's amazing.
Love it.
Hey, awesome. Wealth Wednesdays, first Wednesday of every month. Please show up. I'll be there every time. If I'm not hosting, I'm still going to be in attendance. And Raf, thank you so much for putting this together. Lynn, thank you so much. We have learned so much over the past couple months, and I can't wait to see what the next 8 months has to offer as we paint this picture by numbers, one step at a time until we get to finally see what that all looks like at the end. So thank you.
Yeah, for anybody that wants to stick around for a few minutes, I'll stick around for a few to chat it up, but anybody that wants to, you know, to bounce, all good. Thank you for coming. It's been a ton of fun. Learned a lot tonight. So I hope you did too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yep. Anybody have any questions? Anything to add? We good? Everyone's hiding out. This is an awesome conversation. Hey, Ray.
Hey. Don, actually, one quick question. So a lot of it, the whole setup kind of relies on the text code. Like, how likely is it going to be that there's some kind of change in the code that would kind of make the whole setup kind of collapse? I'm just curious. Like, I'm hoping that nothing would change so that we can rely on it.
This code was put in the tax code, and this part of the code was in the original tax code. It's never been taken out. Listen, if you don't think that everybody in both parties is not using the strategy to do insider trading, for example.
Political parties, he means.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, they're going to go after other stuff before they're going to go after this. I mean, since when has Washington really gone after, you know, rich people's pocketbooks? It doesn't happen very often.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Plus, it takes Congress, right? Congress can only Congress can change the code. And I don't see that happening very much in our society nowadays.
Well, Don, even if they do change the code, it would have to be for stuff in the future versus things that are kind of currently existing. So if you get it established now, there's a 99.9% chance that you're going to fall under a different set of laws because that's when it was established.
Right.
And most of these trusts are in perpetuity. So, you're going to be under one law set for basically ever.
Yeah, just every 21 years you renew it, and that's it.
Yeah.
Hey, Don, this has been great. I'm glad that Raf asked his question about W-2 earners because I'm one of those. My wife has an S-corp, but I'm thinking like for myself, like I work at Apple, so like I have a decent base salary, but the majority of my income comes through RSUs. And so like whenever those vest, like is my strategy just charitable trust? That angle that you explained, or is there any other like take on this?
Can you get Apple to agree to not have those? You don't own them personally; that your trust would own
them. RSUs, yeah.
Oh, that the RSUs themselves. I don't know. That's a good point.
That's the best way to do it because if you can have that tied to your trust EIN number instead of your social, then that is investment income. That's passive income, and they will not be taxable. With a trust.
Got it.
Yeah. And even
great.
If you
okay.
DR, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because that's the other thing too. It's like, you know, equity in companies and you know, like
you don't want to invest anything personally or even with an LLC anymore. You want to do it in the trust because any income that comes into that is not taxable.
Right.
I do caution Apple, depending on what state you're in, a lot of Apple employees are based out of California. California is very stringent on its trusts, what it allows in the trust. So definitely take a look at that if you're not familiar.
Okay.
Because California obviously likes to get its pound of flesh from everyone about everything.
This trust does not fall under state jurisdiction. It is not required to register in the state either.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I do remember.
So you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
With this
most trusts, you have to get. locally register it in the state that you would operate in, right? If there are yet any passable or, you know, passive operations, you'd have to register at the state. But for this,
not this
trust.
I'm sorry if I'm naive in that and I missed it. What the trust, where is it registered effectively?
You register with the IRS, with the EIN number, that's it.
Just a federal EIN, that's it.
Fantastic.
Which is nice for me as a real estate investor, because now, you know, before I always had property deeded to my S corp, and everybody just go on, you know, sunbiz.org in, you know, in Florida, and they could see everything about me, my address, all that kind of stuff, you know. But now it's in, you know, Edding Trust, and it's like, what's Edding Trust? We're not going to find anything about me. Yeah. So I have much more anonymity when it comes to my real estate investments now than I would when I was doing it in my S corp.
Yeah, I have some privacy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, awesome. Well, I've got to jump. I got some other stuff I got to jump into. But Don, thanks so much. I hope everyone has a great night. Thanks for joining. Any questions? Obviously, we have our Slack group. Don, if you use Slack, we'd be happy to invite you in to a guest channel or whatever.
Sure. I have Slack.
Any questions? A lot of fun. So
yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Great.
Go Blue. And we'll chat with you all soon. I'm going to end that. Actually, I didn't realize we were recording.